Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
Hey, everybody. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome to Beekeeping for Newbies. Thank you so very much for taking the time to listen. I do appreciate you. And as always, feel free to reach out, Jeff at beekeepingfornewbies.com. That's N-E-W-B-E-E-S.com. You can also go check out our homepage, beekeepingfornewbies.com. We've got links to all of our In the News articles that are posted up there. We've got the link to the Discord room and a couple other pieces of info in there for some social media links and YouTube and all that fun stuff. So definitely catch up with us over there. All right, everybody, this week we have episode 58. It is our interview with Charlotte Wiggins. For those of you who may remember from before, Charlotte is a master beekeeper, and we had her on a while back to talk all about beekeeping, had a really fun discussion with her. We talked about a couple of books that she's written, things for starting a new bee club, and then another book for beekeeping skills and things. And we decided to bring her back again. And well, she decided to grace us with the opportunity to have her on again, I should say, for a second visit, because Charlotte, in addition to being a master beekeeper, is also a master gardener. We were talking in our Discord room, and a few people had made some comments, asked a few questions around how can we do things within the garden that will not impact the pollinators, you know, things that we can do in the garden that would be herbicide free and more natural solutions. Charlotte, also being a master gardener, I thought she's the perfect person for the job. So I reached out to her. I definitely recommend having a pen and paper handy if possible, because there's a lot of information that you're going to get today. I mean, we're talking about bees, birds, butterflies, caterpillars, cicadas, everything is in this today. If you can think about it and it's in a garden, we're talking about it. So ladies and gentlemen, back by popular demand, Charlotte Wiggins. Charlotte, welcome back.
Jeff, thank you so much. It's a delight to be back.
Well, we are super excited to have you on. I think I mentioned to you before that we had just overwhelmingly positive feedback from last time, and we were chatting in our Discord room the other day, and a couple of folks had some questions around things in the garden. And I said, hey, I've got this friend who might be able to help us out here. So thank you for volunteering to field some of the questions and to just have a fun little chat with us again today.
Thanks for inviting me. It's always fun to talk gardening and bees.
Well, so what's new out in Missouri? What do you have going on out there?
So here in mid-Missouri, the excitement has been about the cicadas. The year 13 cicadas have been eclosing from the ground. I'm on a limestone hillside, so I haven't had very many. So I've actually gone to friends' houses who have wonderful soil, and they've had the whole ground in their yard covered in these lovely little creatures that have been living underground using their little straw mouths to live off tree roots. And they come out every 13 years to basically mate, lay eggs in tree limbs, and then go back down to underground for another 13 years. What's amazing to me is this is part of nature's very complicated web where these bugs reinvigorate nature. We've had 5 years of drought, so these bugs have come out. These insects have come out. They become food for everything from turtles to birds, which then reinvigorates those creatures. They also aerate the soil. They provide holes in the soil so they can get, the soil can get water. and they basically trim tree limbs themselves because they make little cuts in the tree limbs to put their eggs. It's just fascinating to see something that you won't see every year. And then, of course, if you're in Illinois, you get to see two different cicada cycles come out. And in Illinois, you don't see that happen once every 200 years. So I have entomologist friends who actually travel to Illinois, very much like people travel to see the solar eclipse. So it's been pretty exciting this summer.
That is. Now, do you know, I don't know if you know off the top of your head, but do you know what's unique to Illinois or the area surrounding there that would have that be kind of like the focal point for both the 13 and 17 year coming together at the same time?
I think it's just that the cicadas are living there.
Oh, okay.
They happen to have the two different cicadas that are living in the Illinois area.
Gotcha. Okay.
Lincoln. But they say that the last time it happened was when Abraham Lincoln was president. He's from Illinois. I don't know what other characteristics make it unique to Illinois.
Okay. You know, it's funny. I remember being a kid, and I think if I remember everything correctly, I think it would have been the 17-year cicada, and I think I was probably somewhere in the 14 or 15-year-old range. And I remember my mom and some of her friends had this place they used to go, and they would hang out there, you know, occasionally every now and then on a Friday night. And it was like a local restaurant, and they had a little bar area, and they'd have live entertainment come in. But one of the things they did up there one time during this is they had like a cicada eating contest. And I remember this story about how they brought them all in, and they had different ketchup and different things they were trying to do with them. And I just thought, well, I guess every 17 years you got to come up with something creative, but I thought that was a little unusual there.
Well, you can't eat cicadas. You know, you want to get them when they're in the nymph stage, when they're still coming out of their first shell. They're cousins to shrimp. And I actually went looking for them thinking, well, I'll try them, but I could never catch them. You're supposed to catch them at night. And I did go out with my flashlight trying to find them, but I didn't have that many candidates on my property. And I wasn't going to go looking for them in my neighbor's property. But you're supposed to be able to eat them because they are, and they taste like shrimp. They're cousins to shrimp. So I missed out on that opportunity. They're winding down here in where I live. But it certainly would be an opportunity to try something that you wouldn't be able to get every day.
You know, I fully expected you to say, like a grasshopper, for example. Like, oh, Jeff, you don't want to eat that. That's really not safe. They
no,
carry all kinds
no.
of bacteria.
That's right. No, you want to get them where you don't have that tough exoskeleton that's crunchy. Yeah.
Sure, sure.
But I certainly would try it if I could find them.
Well, we'll see if we can track something down. Maybe there's somebody in the area who can package some up for you and send them your way. Maybe somebody listening.
There we go. That would be fun.
So I heard a rumor that you have some monarch butterflies hanging around today.
Well, actually, they're Fritillaria butterflies. They look like monarchs, but yes, I have them on milkweed. I have this one pink milkweed plant that decided to grow in a little flower bed. Now, remember, I am not a formal garden at all. I'm on a hillside where my neighbor said nothing would grow. And so whatever decides to grow in my garden is welcome. And they're growing in this one spot that for one reason, years ago, I decided I wanted to try to move it. And it decided that it's going to stay. So I have given up, and I enjoy going out to see what's visiting this particular pink milkweed. And this morning, there were 7 Fritillaria butterflies. And it was just the most beautiful sight. I've been watching them for a couple weeks now. And the Fritillaria butterflies are interesting because they lay their eggs in the fall on wild violets. And the caterpillars eclose from those eggs before winter, and they winter over on the violets, and then they come out in the spring, and they eat the violet flowers, and then they become Fritillaria butterflies. I've had a ton this year. I don't remember the last time I've had so many. And so I was just trying to understand why I have so many. And I have lots of violets. I've always loved violets. This is a 42-year-old garden. And so I've been enjoying them. I also have monarch butterflies. I've seen about 5. Years ago, I'm in the monarch flight path. I'm a monarch way station. In other words, I'm a registered a path for the monarch butterflies, but I used to have literally clouds of them come through in the fall, and I don't see as many anymore. And partly because the numbers have gone down. They fly through here on their way south to Mexico where they overwinter, and then they fly back up. And their food, the path of food is what guides them. And the different milkweeds, for example, the ones that are growing here, when the milkweed dies back, that guides the monarchs to keep going south. And then as the milkweed grows, that also guides them to go north. And so their food sources are dwindling, which is affecting how many of them are surviving. Their numbers are really low. I doubt that they will survive much longer, which is sad to hear. But that's the nature of pollinators, whether they're bees or butterflies, their food sources are they're challenged to find the foods that they need. And they only eat a certain type of plant. In the case of monarchs, their caterpillars eat a certain kind of milkweed.
So that's fascinating. You know, there's so much that I think that we just go through day to day and we don't even really think about. Do you think that what's going on with them is more tied to just like a natural evolution of how things progress in nature? Or do you think it's, well, we've come through and we've added a lot of neighborhoods and we got sprawl and crawl and we've got now a lot of people who were, for example, fields that used to be just open fields and pasture land and now it's being used, you know, as maybe a new development. Do you think it's kind of a man-made issue?
I think it's a combination of things. We certainly have overdeveloped, you know, we have too much development. We have a propensity to monocrops, soybean fields and corn fields. We've lost some biodiversity. A lot of these species depend on a particular crop. For example, the ruffled bumblebees that used to be prevalent in the Midwest, you know, they needed a certain kind of plants that were only available on prairies, and the prairies are gone. If you look at the monarch butterflies, they needed milkweed. A lot of the milkweed is gone. Think about where you see milkweed. At least in Missouri, we see it on roadways. Well, what do our transportation departments do? They cut down the plants on the roadways because they're used to cutting those down. Now, some places, I know Ohio and I think Indiana, are now allowing the milkweed to stay on roadways. It doesn't hurt anybody. It's just they're in the habit of cutting them down. They're starting to leave the milkweed up because they know that that's food for monarchs. So that's good. We have to change our habits in some cases. We have overuse of pesticides. That doesn't help because that also impacts a lot of these very delicate, small species that they can't tolerate the level of pesticides that we apply to some of these plants. So there's a combination of things.
Sure.
But yes, I think we need to rethink how we're doing things and be more sensitive to the uniqueness and the variety that we need to reintroduce back into our world.
So that raises an interesting question. How do you think that happens? You know, how do we reintroduce that, you know, or to restore things back to how they, not necessarily how they once were, but how do we adapt in a way that can restore some of these species and things that are kind of dwindling?
Well, I think we need to start thinking about our own gardens. You know, that's where we can start. We can't change the world necessarily, but we can start in our gardens. Start by not planting grass. If we have grass, start by minimizing the grass that we have in our gardens. We have so much grass planted in this country that it's equivalent to an area larger than the size of Texas. So if we start looking at our gardens and saying, realizing that grass provides nothing to the biodiversity of our world, yes, I know it's a pretty area, but it's dead basically to providing food for our pollinators. June is National Pollinator Month, by the way. You know, start with one flower bed and expand it by a foot. Take a foot of grass out and just expand that one flower bed that you might have and plant something that will help pollinators. Zinnia seeds are the easiest thing that you can plant. You can find them at most garden centers. start with zinnias and take a look at what gets attracted to those zinnia seeds. You can save them once they finish the season, dry those zinnia seeds to plant next year. Once you get hooked on zinnia seeds, you're going to try something else. There are a lot of seeds you can plant. You can then look into perennials. Perennials may take 3 years to get them established. They come back every year after you get them established in your area. Get a soil test so that you know what will grow well in your soil so you don't waste a lot of money in planting things. And I think once you start seeing what's happening in your yard, you'll be more and more encouraged to plant more things. I have friends who come over to my garden and just sit on some of the benches I have and watch what's happening in my garden. The birds put up a birdhouse. Birds are wonderful natural pest control. Minimize the use of chemicals in your garden. Have the balance. You know, sometimes we strive for perfection in our garden. We should be striving for balance. A birdhouse will bring birds that will then eat the caterpillars of things that you don't want in your garden. And it will take a little time, but be patient. You can strive for that. I haven't used chemicals in my garden in 40 years, and I don't have any problems.
So that is actually a perfect segue for one of the primary reasons. And I think I mentioned it to you earlier. I had so many folks who reached out and they said, Jeff, it was so great having Charlotte on the show. Thank you so much. When is she coming back again? And
oh, great.
And when I had mentioned, you know, I said, hey, you guys know that she's not just a master beekeeper. She's a master gardener as well, because we had this discussion that popped up in the Discord. And people were specifically asking, hey, what do you recommend for pest control in the garden? What kind of natural herbicides are there? And that's where I said, I've got a friend who might be able to help us out with that. So, well, you know, what do you, I mean, I know that's a very broad subject, but I'll just turn the reins over to you and you can let us know what you think.
Sure. So Japanese beetle season is coming up. Those are beautiful little iridescent green bugs that decimate a lot of people's gardens. They eat Rose of Sharon, roses, anything that's edible in your garden, they seem to take over. And I think it was in 2014 that I noticed them in my garden. Actually, one of my brothers was visiting, and he's a big gardener. And he looked at one of my Rose of Sharon's, and he said, well, you've got something eating your Rose of Sharon's. And I said, oh, yes, I go out with soapy water in a coffee can early in the morning, and I knocked the coffee can under the Rose of Sharon bush and knocked the Japanese bugs into the soapy water and get them off that way. Now, it doesn't help that particular year, but it prevents them from burrowing into the ground and forming bugs, that grubs that will then hatch and out and form more Japanese beetles the next year. The other thing that I did was I bought nematodes. You can find them that will particularly kill the grubs that are the Japanese beetle grubs. And if you treat, I think the ones I bought were $24 or $25, and they treat 100 square feet. And then you could take some of that soil the next year and then treat another 100 square feet if you want to buy, you know, the nematodes for your whole property. You can also get milky spores, and that will treat the soil. Again, these are natural biologics that you're adding to your soil, and they will dissolve the grubs that are in your soil that produce Japanese beetles. And I have not had any bugs 2 years after I did that. I joke about I have three, you know, Harold, Eunice, and Margarita last year. I just don't. And if I see them, I will pick them and dispatch them. And I do walk through when I know to start looking for them, and I get rid of them. I don't let them sit on whatever plant they are. I do get rid of them. And I don't have chickens, although chickens like to eat them. You know, you just get rid of them. Now, aphids is another bug that people get very upset about. And I like to see aphids in my garden because I want ladybugs. And I do have a little population of ladybugs. And that's what I mentioned, balance. If you want to have ladybugs in your garden, which are good to have, you need to have a food source for them. And they eat aphids. So if I see aphids, I know I'll be able to support the ladybugs. in the garden. So you have to be careful about getting rid of all of the bugs you don't like, because you need to have food for them. Hornworms, tomato hornworms. Oh, my gosh. More people bemoan tomato hornworms, right? Nobody wants tomato hornworms. And I have had tomato hornworms for years, and I love to see them because they turn into hawk moths, which are beautiful pollinators. And I only, this year, I think I've got four tomatoes. And what I do is I talk about setting one tomato aside, tomato plant aside, and I will give, I'll put my tomato hornworms on that one tomato plant. I separate it from the others, and I will give that tomato plant to the tomato hornworm so they have food, so the caterpillars can become hawk moths. And at the end of the season, that tomato plant will come inside for the winter. I will winter over one tomato plant. And I've had one tomato plant that's wintered over inside for 5 years now. They're perennial plants in Peru, right, where they're native. But here in the Midwest, I'm in hardiness zone 6B now. They can't winter over outside. So I normally bring one inside, and the tomato hornworms have something to eat. They stay off. If I find one on the other tomatoes, I pick it up and take it to the, you know, sacrificial tomato plant. And they get to something to eat, and then they disappear, and then I get to see the moths later. But they, you know, people want to crush them, and they do all sorts of crazy things to them. Remember, they're just like the caterpillars of monarch butterflies or anything else that you might, swallowtails, that you might want to have in your yard. They are pollinators. So don't destroy them. Just give them a food source and let them be. It just amazes me how we want to vilify them when they're just like any other pollinator.
I had no idea. I would get them and toss them. Get out of here. What do you do? Because they're not.
I know.
Yeah, they're not very attractive. So they're not cute and fuzzy.
No. Well, and there's a parasitic wasp that'll lay eggs on hornworms, and people are always looking for those parasitic wasps. And that is part of nature. Again, it's that balance that nature provides that, you know, the worms, the hornworms get on plants, and the parasitic wasp will lay eggs on the hornworm, and then the hornworm, you know, will basically get eaten from the inside, and that's okay. But if you still want to have some of the moths, you need to feed the hornworm. It needs to have food. It's not going to be able to become a moth without a food source. And my gosh, let's face it, how many of us have way too many tomato plants? I know I do. And so, you know, when I get that six pack at the farmer's market, I always say, okay, one of those is for the hornworms. Because even with five tomato plants, it's way too many tomatoes. And so I think we all can sacrifice one tomato plant to feed the hornworms and contribute back to nature by having moths that can survive.
Yeah, I definitely have to look up and do some more research. I want to see what that moth looks like. I pulled up the butterfly here, and that's absolutely beautiful.
Isn't it? And it's fun to see little ones, too, because you know that that's the next generation that's coming along. So I just saw one this morning. That I saw the seven, but there were two small ones, and I'm thinking, okay, now how do I track that back to where you know, you're not going to be able to. But obviously there's more butterflies that are eclosing on this property when you've got little ones coming up, too. Sure. That's exciting.
Yeah, and I'm looking here. Now, the picture I'm looking at is a Gulf fritillary. Is that different from the species that you would have at your place? Or?
Yeah, there's a great fritillaria, which is a black and white one. That's the one that they think may be endangered.
Okay.
And then there's, I forget. I looked them up several weeks ago. There's like five different fritillarias. There's one that has black and big brown spots on the outside.
Mormon?
And then yes.
And then we have a great spangled.
Yes, mine's a great spangled.
Oh, they're absolutely beautiful. And then a Zerene Diana.
Yeah, I don't think I have that one. I don't think I have those. I know I've got the great spangled. but they are. And they're often mistaken for monarchs.
Oh, okay. I can see that in some of these here where they do have some familiar kind of markings.
Yes, they're yellow. They've got some black markings on them, so if you can't get close up like I can, I was within 3 feet of them, you can very often mistake them for monarchs.
Okay.
As most of you know, I'm a big fan of the outdoors, and most of my time is dedicated to beekeeping and gardening-related discussions. But you probably did not know that one of my responsibilities as a kid was caring for our houseplants. Yes, part of my $5 a week allowance went towards making sure all of the houseplants were healthy and happy. We used to have shamrocks, Christmas cactus, philodendron, and more. Which leads us to today's podcast sponsor, and a special thanks to Palm Street. Palm Street is the best live shopping app for the plant lover community. You can buy and sell rare plants, crystals, ceramics, and other unique goods. Connect with trusted plant sellers and nurseries that sell nationwide. Shop 24/7 and with live human customer support. What I love most about Palm Street is joining a live stream where sellers walk through all the details and characteristics of the plants they're offering. You can get live answers to your questions and see what questions others have asked as well. It's such a great way to engage for buyers and sellers. And as a special offer, new users will receive $5 app credit, 10% off their first order, and up to $6 off shipping for 3 orders. Palm Street, available on Google Play or the App Store.
When I was little, my grandmother had bird feeders and a bird bath in her backyard. Some of my favorite memories growing up were listening to her tell me everything she knew about the feathered friends that visited her yard daily. How amazing would it have been for us to be able to capture images and videos of that experience and to be able to share them with others? Well, if you're ready to take your backyard bird watching to the next level, FeatherSnap makes Wi-Fi-enabled smart bird feeders that blend the best of technology and nature. Get a high-def glimpse of your feathered friends with a top-of-the-line camera so every visitor can be seen with clarity and detail. A unique dual-feeder bin helps attract more species, and built-in solar panels keep your camera's battery going strong. FeatherSnap's mobile app creates a truly immersive experience, allowing you to collect and organize your favorite pics and videos and earn badges along the way. Best of all, FeatherSnap offers expert-trained AI identification of more than 275 North American species thanks to their in-house ornithologist. Check them out today at FeatherSnapCam.com. That's FeatherSnapCam.com.
Here in America, work is in trouble. We've offshored our manufacturing, sent away good jobs, and lost so much ability to make things. American Giant is pushing back against that tide. They make high-quality clothing for a summer wardrobe you'll love, all made right here in the USA. Support America's workers and get 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, code STAPLE20.
Let me bring up another thing that you can do in the garden for pest control. And this is something I've been doing for many, many years. So you can look at online. There's a brand new book about companion gardening. And some of the master gardeners will poo-poo this. But you can plant things together that will work together. And I always tell people, if you can eat it together, if you cook and it makes your dish that you're cooking better, tomato and basil, for example, you can plant it together and they will work together. I love basil. And so I use basil to deter bugs around the things I plant in my garden better than marigolds. Marigolds have been hybridized enough that they don't have that pungent smell that deters bugs anymore. And so I like basil better planted around my tomatoes, for example. Look up companion planting. There's a revised version. I forget the name of the author.
Okay.
But look at planting things together that will work together. This is not a rose planting area, but I do have a few roses in my garden. They are edible, by the way. And you can plant onions around roses to deter bugs on your roses. You can plant basil, for example, instead of marigolds. You can plant things together that you can use in your garden, herbs that are excellent to improve flavor of your food that can also deter bugs. So that's something that we've forgotten or lost in our gardening repertoire that will work very well, and you don't have to use herbicides or insecticides.
And you said earlier that, I mean, you're 100%. You don't have, there's no chemical in your garden, right?
Oh, no, I haven't. I haven't used chemicals in 40. I've been here since 1982. I've not used one chemical in my yard.
Now, how long did it take you to get that balance? How long did it take you to get everything? Because I think a lot of people, there's a couple of people, I think, who have mentioned that, like, hey, I've only been, you know, gardening for a couple of years, and they're new. To really get that garden established and get it to where it's kind of self-sufficient.
Yeah, well, so the one thing you have to remember is you have to be patient. So when I planted a bunch of strawberries, for example, they were, the turtles found them before I did. So I now have I'm trying to remember what you call this, but it's netting that you would use for a bridal veil and plastic piping that I bought at our local home and garden center over the strawberry beds to keep the turtles out. Either that or the turtles are very well dressed when they get married, because I need to keep things out of some of these beds, and I don't have them in rows. That's the other thing that I don't do. I have tomatoes in the middle of flower beds, and I have things mixed up. My fruit trees are lined up here along my paths, but they're in the middle of flower beds. So I don't make it easy for the deer and whatever else might be living here with me to find things. They have to go look for it, which makes it easier for the fruit trees and whatever I'm planting here to survive. I now have things in containers on my deck, and so I can get to it easier because I'm on a hillside. It's not easy. There's no flat area to plant here.
Okay.
So the container garden is right off my kitchen, so I can go find things. I have an asparagus bed I'm looking at out here, the wind, it's my window. I had an herb garden that got torn up when I had to put the siding on the house. I'm gonna replant that here this year. But you have to think about how do you protect things without using herbicides and insecticides. The nematodes that I put in, the Japanese beetles were the worst thing that I had, and the critters that want to come along and eat things that are here. Part of it is making sure that they can't access the plants that you have. And the nematodes and the milky spores were wonderful. And then being patient, you know, and making sure that what you're planting is not available. And that's hard if you're homesteading and you're planting everything in a row. I will tell you that if you plant a row of something, make sure the next row are marigolds or there's some plant or basil that's going to deter bugs. I know around here people are always complaining to me about squash bugs. They always have a problem with squash bugs. Well, what do? They plant the squash too early. They plant it before June 1st. That means they're planting it when the temperature is not hot enough to deter the bugs themselves. And they also are not checking under the leaves of the brand new squash plants where the eggs are being laid. So don't plant them too early and watch for under the leaves, because you can remove the eggs by hand and then you won't have the problem. You know, so it does take a little bit of time. It takes vigilance on your part. It takes knowing when to plant them and patience.
Yeah, so do you recommend that, like what you just mentioned with the squash, to, you know, you talked about, you know, not monocropping and not having single things in an area.
Yes.
If you had an area where maybe one year you're growing, you know, one thing, it almost sounds like it's a really good idea for a lot of reasons. Not just for some of the, what do you call it, sort of like the biodiversity of the soil and things like that, but it's also, hey, there are things that may be attracted to that. So if it's not there the following year, maybe removing that food source from there doesn't allow them to have a reason to stick around, kind of.
Oh, absolutely. You need to rotate your crops. Yeah. Never plant more than 2 years in the same spot.
Okay.
Because if you do, the bugs that might get used to that food source will establish themselves in your soil. And then they will just come back because they've got a food source there. So you want to rotate that. And you want to make sure your soil's healthy. So if you do nothing else, even if you're container gardening, you need to be composting. We throw 40% of our food away in this country. And so if you don't compost that food, and I joke about your freezer has a drawer that comes out, they don't have it marked, but that's your composting drawer. and that you put a bag in there, a plastic bag, you want something you get at your grocery store, and whatever kitchen scraps that you have, you throw that in that bag. And when it's full, you take it outside and dig a hole around whatever tree you have, or maybe a flower bed, make a little trench, and you throw that stuff in there and you cover it up. And if you have creatures around there, they might find it, put some rocks on top of that. And that'll get you in the habit of composting. And then once you are comfortable doing that, get yourself a 5-gallon paint bucket from your store. Make sure it's food grade. Put some holes in the bottom. Get yourself a lid. They sell them with lids. I think they're like $5 lid and the paint gallon container. And then start throwing your kitchen scraps in there. Throw some leaves, dried leaves in there. You want 50-50. Put some water in there to put the lid on there. Put a big rock on top or some bricks. And you're starting to hit some compost in there. It will start cooking. And when it's nice and dark and black, you can then scatter that on your flower bed. And then you'll graduate to something bigger, maybe a 55-gallon drum. Or you can buy composters now. That's what you need. That's what's going to feed the little microorganisms that are in your soil and keep your soil healthy. And they'll take care of whatever bugs are in your soil as well. That's probably the biggest thing that you can do to keep your garden healthy and your soil healthy.
Most definitely.
And then you don't need to go get fertilizers. You know, you want to have your compost. I just planted. Well, this is funny. So every year I add dwarf fruit trees to this hillside, and I do it. And I have a neighbor that just shakes his head when he says, "Well, what did you plant this year?" You know, because it's a limestone hillside, and I do have fruit trees. Some of them do really well, and some, you know, you don't even know if they've survived. Well, I was cleaning out this little garden area right in front of this window, and I found this cherry tree. It has more zigzags in it than a zebra does, okay? It's a dwarf cherry tree, and I remember planting it, and I forgot that I planted it because it died back, and it takes a while for roots to establish themselves on this hillside. So the top can die back, but the root is struggling and surviving, and then all of a sudden the top starts growing. So I say it takes the roots first to grow, and then it will take some time for it to shoot, for the top to grow, and then it will take some time for it to fruit. So root, shoot, fruit. Well, this little cherry tree apparently survived, but it's got the strangest looking trunk to it. And I must have planted it 15 years ago, and it's a whole maybe 3 feet. And I looked at this little thing and I said, okay, you've survived this long. So I trimmed the dogwood over it. I gave it a little stake. I went out and gave it some compost. And I'm going, okay, you and me, buddy, we're going to make it.
The little tree that could, huh?
The little tree that could. And my neighbor was over here the other day and he looks at this thing and he goes, "That's the ugliest trunk I've ever seen." And I said, "Don't you talk like that in front of my cherry tree." You know, and it's the resilience of nature. You know, I could have sworn this thing died and was not going to make it. But I mean, it is sitting here and it's going to grow. And I was looking through my diary trying to figure out what year I planted this. Probably 15 years ago. And it's still sitting here. Now, in another 5 years, it might be putting some height on it. It could take that long for these roots to find themselves to this limestone hillside. But the compost may make the difference. I don't remember. I put compost in when I planted it, but I have not been giving up compost since then.
Okay.
So the cherry tree that's 5 feet, maybe 6 feet to the right of that, has been getting compost, and it has cherries on it.
Oh, wow.
So because I knew that that one survived. So I'm going to be adding, making sure it gets a little more compost throughout the season. So composting, you don't need to go buy anything. You know, maybe 5 gallons, $5 to buy your paint, your food grade bucket at your local garden center or your local big store, and you're making your own compost so that you can feed your own garden. It's worth every penny that you spend.
So as a testament to that, and I'm a huge fan of composting, and when I lived in a rural area, we had just moved in, we had our first single family home, the kids were still really little. And in fact, well, we only had one of them at the time. Two of them hadn't even been born yet. But we had a nice little 1 acre area, and I took some 2x4s, and I went out back, and I surrounded it with chicken wire, and just that was the beginning of my compost. And I would
oh, good for you!
Oh, yeah, all the leaves in the yard, and all the food scraps, and everything went in there. And of course, we started a garden, and you know, the garden really wasn't super great for about the first 2 years. But about year number three, I had this huge, huge area of compost now. And to hit the bonus round, my dad shared a property line with the horse farm. And I said,
oh, nice.
Yeah. So I said, hey, Dick, can you do me a favor? He says, yeah. And I said, can you talk to the folks over at the horse farm and see if they wouldn't mind giving me some manure? And he says, yeah, no problem. So he calls me back, a couple of days later and says, hey, I need you to come by the house here and help me out with something. And I said, okay, that was not uncommon for him to ask for a hand. And he was about 20 minutes away. So I go over there and he goes, hey, look in the back of the truck. And I look in there and he has a bed full of manure. And we hit the jackpot. So I took all that horse manure back, threw that into the compost. And then the rest of it went into that year's tomatoes and the rest of the garden. The tomatoes that I had were the biggest tomatoes that we've ever had that year.
Yep. Isn't it amazing? It's magic. It really is magical.
Oh, it was something else. I just couldn't believe it. But, when I moved to, more of a suburban area, it wasn't quite as practical to have that large, that large 8-foot by 8-foot kind of space. So I have one of those that's a little container that sits up, little legs, and you just has a little crank. You can turn it every now and then. And that's great. Yeah, it's great for around the house. But your 5 gallon container, what I love about that is it's very mobile. So you're doing your composting in that, and then you're moving it, wherever it needs to be spread and dispersed. Now, you mentioned something. I got a couple of notes here. One of them is, when you, I started laughing when you said, open up your freezer drawer. There's a compartment there. Yeah. As soon as you said that, I was thinking about, I already have a composting area. It's in my refrigerator, and it's that drawer that you put out with all the fresh vegetables, because it seems like it always ends up, everything ends up becoming a big composted mess in there after you
a good one too.
You forget about it. But one thing that you mentioned that I thought was actually really important, I've told people on the beekeeping side of things, hey, keep a log with you. When you go out and you do inspections, hey, hive number one, I saw this, I'm concerned about this, these things are looking great, next time make sure you look for XYZ. Hive number two, same kind of thing. But you made a point when you were talking about, hey, I got to go back and double check my diary. Do you maintain like a garden diary and notes around the garden?
Oh, I do. I have one. It's an 8.5 by 11. It's a 3-inch fine diary. I started maybe 2. Don't have some years I was more detailed than others, but when I buy something, trees or do something particular, arbors or put a pond in, or that's all noted in the diary. I have the same diary for the house. If the alarm system gets fixed, I'll have who comes by and what they do, because I don't always remember what year it was, how much I paid. So I do keep the diary in the garden. As a matter of fact, that's what I'm looking and still trying to find what year I put this little dwarf cherry tree in. And I'll have a note in there. Matter of fact, I wish that I had put plant tags on all the trees, what year I planted them. And so this year I've gone back and tried to put plant tags on all these trees so that I know what year they were put in, so I know how long they've been here. And I'm going to put some more in this year, and they already have plant tags on them. So before they go into the ground, they already have their plant tags, what source they were, and what year they're going in.
Okay.
So yes, I do keep a diary. And it's fun to go back and look to say, oh my, I put that in 1996 or that was in 2000 or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I think
it helped.
Yeah, just like you would with bees, with IPM and keeping track of pests and things that were present,
yeah,
things you did that solved a problem, and then you add a separate section for this pest. And what did I do when I saw that pest? Oh, here it is, you know, yeah.
I love zinnias, and every year, I can't tell you how many years, I would wait to put zinnias in because it can be a very wet spring here, and zinnias don't like being wet. And so by the time I would put them in, or I would want to put them in, it would be too late. And so this year I went ahead and put them in, and it's raining right now. And I was just thinking, I wonder how they'll do. And I thought, I'm glad I finally put them in, because I would put them in. There'd be a note in my diary every year. I didn't get the zinnias in this year. You know, I put them in this year, and I'm just going to see how well they do. Yes. But I love them, and the pollinators love them. So I'm glad I took the risk instead of putting it off. And see how well they do. So,
okay, well, I'm going to jump over here and I see. So there's one thing that a gentleman shared, and I wish I could have, I should have sent you this link ahead of time so that you could take a look and give us your thoughts, but you might already have an idea or be familiar with this already. It's a gentleman who's out of Northern Finland. And the subject of this particular video is, should our bees fly around loaded up with mushrooms? Can mushrooms save the bees? Have you heard anything at all with mushrooms relative to honeybees?
Yes, that's been a very popular recent topic. There's some research being done. It has not been confirmed, but there is research being done about whether mushrooms, the mycelium, can help bees. It's an interesting topic.
Okay.
Still to be determined.
Okay, fair enough. So the next one I have here, it says, is there a specific resource or reliable method of knowing when my area is in fact in a nectar flow or a dearth and how severe it is? Anything that might be online or something that I can look around in? Now, my gut would go to the bees and to say, well, as you see a ramp up in brood production, pollen coming in, that's kind of a good indicator that it's ramping up. When you see brood production diminishing to almost nothing in many cases, that's a good indicator it's going down. But I'm thinking maybe they're probably thinking of something that there's a source that would say, hey, based on your zip code, your region, you know, these are what you would typically expect to see. But any thoughts on that?
Well, I think NASA has the National Aeronautic, yes, Space Administration has a website that has a list of plants and when they bloom. That would be one indicator that you can use. But probably your best indication is your local bee club and the more experienced beekeepers that are talking about the nectar flow. In general, in the U.S., your bees, your plants start producing nectar between 74 and 86 degrees Fahrenheit. That's the sweet spot when the plants are ready to reproduce. It has to be sunny, no wind. They have to have enough moisture in the soil, enough water in the soil so that they're not stressed. They're not stressed by wind. The plants themselves are ready to reproduce, which means that they're producing pollen, and they produce the nectar to attract the pollinators, who are going to move the pollen from plant to plant. By the time the temperatures reach 86 degrees, and that is the magic number, especially if it's very windy and it's really, the humidity is hot, it could be high, it could be even less than 86 degrees, but the 86 degree temperature is the point at which the plants shut down the nectar and the pollen production and go into survival mode. Most plants do. That's when the pollen and nectar production stops. They will also stop if there's a lot of rain. The rain will wash the pollen away and wash the nectar production away, and it will take the plants a little time to restart the production of that assuming that the conditions are correct for them to want to reproduce. So you need to talk to people in your area who are more experienced at that and who are watching what's happening within your hives about the nectar and pollen production. If you're not experienced at that, you can actually watch what's happening within your hive to see what your bees are bringing in and what they're storing within the frames to know what's happening with your nectar flow. But if you're not experienced at that, talk to your local bee clubs. Most of your beekeepers will be talking about your nectar and your pollen production and sharing that with other people.
Yeah, I think that's a great suggestion. That's one thing I've been a big proponent and advocate for from the very beginning when we first started the podcast. I said, hey, get out there, join a bee club, talk to local people. And you hit several nails on the head there with everything you just said. You know, one of them being, for example, where I live, I can talk very specifically about everything that is happening right here at my house. And it's really easy for me to tell you about when the flow starts and when things tend to end. But because of the fact that I'm in a unique situation, I mean, I live on a peninsula, I'm surrounded by water. You can drive 15, you know, within 10 or 15 miles of here, the forage is completely different, much more abundant. You don't have to be that far away to actually have a much better experience with me. I know what's about to happen. Like right about now, we're getting cut off.
Right.
So, and it's a very different experience. So that was the one thing. The other part is it's a sad thing that I don't admit, and I'm just going to keep this between you and I. I'm not going to tell anybody else about this, but I'm colorblind. I have a red-green color deficiency. And it's tough because you can actually see the pollen coming in and you say, oh, well, there's some oranges and some yellows and there's a little bit of red over here. And if you know what those colors are, you can quite often map those to a chart of some sort that says, hey, if you're seeing these colors, it's most likely these things for your area. Some of us, like me, I just say, I see pollen on those pollen sacks. I think we're good.
Oh, man, that's a challenge for sure.
Well, the good news is for me, it's a red-green. So I see all the yellows and oranges and blue and all of that. It's just those red-green shades that kind of mess me up a little bit.
Well, you're right. Nectar flow is very, very local. And I have a couple of people that I mentor that are 10 miles from where I live. And their experience with what's happening with the nectar flow is very different than what I see. And when they tell me that, they start panicking, they're new beekeepers. Oh, I don't see anything coming in. And it's like, that's very possible because your what's happening weather-wise can be very different than what's happening where I'm at. Our nectar flow here in mid-Missouri normally starts in May, maybe April, depending on the weather, and goes through June. This year, it started in February.
Oh, wow.
And then we had a little bit of a cold spell, and then it started back up again. And the other thing that people forget is that when it starts that early, mama doesn't have room to lay because those foragers are bringing that nectar in and the pollen in, and they're filling up the spaces. And so swarming starts early because the brood nest is being filled in with the nectar and the pollen. And the queen bee doesn't have room to lay. And what do people do? They stick that extra new super on top, which is okay if it's a new colony and you've got that brood nest box, a deep or maybe two mediums. But if you already have honey from winter that may still be on there and you're then sticking that super on the top, the queen's not going to cross that honey band. You know, she's not going to cross the super that's full of honey. And so as far as she's concerned, she still doesn't have room to lay. You haven't given her any room to lay.
Sure.
As far as she's concerned. And so the colony will say, well, we still don't have room to lay. And then they swarm. And then people say, well, I gave her room to lay. No, as far as the colony's concerned.
Yeah.
You didn't give them you gave them room, but not room to lay. You need to give the room over the brood nest, not on top of the hive. And so we had some early swarms, and So far, so good in terms of this last spate. We haven't had too many swarm calls. Our local club has. And I'm happy about that because that means I'm hoping that that means beekeepers are doing a better job of staying on top of giving, you know, the mama bee the room that she needs. I know people say, well, that's a natural thing for them to you know, to replicate and whatever. I say that's the beekeeper's job. You know, we're the landlords. We've got hives and we provide them with room, and that's our job. That's our main job, is to make sure that that the queen has room to lay, and we need to make sure that we help them with health. But if we don't do that, we're not doing our job.
No, I agree 100%. I mean, we've got, you know, if nothing else, thinking about the fact that if they're not under somebody's care, they're out in the wild and they essentially become big varroa bombs. I mean, they're,
you know, right.
I mean, and then that affects everybody, and it just goes on from there. And I think that there's an important point that you brought up. Something that I use is to define it is bee space and people space. You know, there's a big difference between when you throw a super on there and like, they have plenty of space. No, that's people space.
That's right. Space.
All right, everybody. Well, I hope you enjoyed part one of episode 58, our interview with Charlotte Wiggins. We're going to take a bit of a pause here and roll things over into episode 59, which will be our part two in the continuation of this episode. So stay with us, and we'll look forward to catching up with you guys next week. And remember, I love y'all, and there's nothing you can do about it.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.
Save big on all your back-to-school needs, all in the Kroger app. Get 3 for $10 on select Kellogg's Giant Size cereal with your card. Then get tender USDA Choice Boneless Beef Chuck Roast for $4.99 a pound with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.